Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
Okay, Nicholas. Just warning everyone, my connection's a little unstable, so bear with me.
Yep, no worries, no worries. We are also joined today by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Doing very well, thank you. Looking forward to our discussion today, how we figure out what's going to happen this week and what has happened over the last 2 to 3 days. I don't know, politics some days is moving faster than other days, so we're getting quite a lot to try and figure out lately.
Indeed. Apologies, first of all, for not having a show on Friday. I unexpectedly suffered from a very awful migraine, and a lot of our regulars were at a workshop, so they couldn't fill in for me. So that's why we didn't have a show on Friday. But anyway, let's get on with the news of today. Oh, one more thing before we start. I would recommend that any of our listeners who are interested in American politics or just interested in shenanigans and crazy happenings, go and look up the story of RFK Jr., the third party candidate in the United States, dumping a bear carcass in New York Central Park story. I can't do it justice here and we don't have time, but it's worth a read. Anyway,
As one
so
does.
of course, as one does, so let us get into, of course, one of the most important news stories of the moment, and that is the ongoing maneuverings in the Government of National Unity. So recently there's been another flurry of harsh media statements and complaining and angriness between the ANC and DA after Helen Ziller said that the DA was the only party that could properly collapse the GNU if it wanted to, and therefore this was in effect an alliance between the DA and the ANC, regardless of the other parties involved. She said that it's that's just cover for the ANC so that they can sell to their alliance partners that they're not in fact in coalition with the DA. I think that's in effect true, although technically speaking, I do think that all of the smaller parties together, if they voted with the ANC, would be able to just have a majority by like one seat or something, which is not a very comfortable place for a government to be. And in practice, I suspect that she's probably right, that that isn't a real majority. But anyway, so let's talk a little bit else about what's been said about the Government of National Unity. One of the things the DA seems to be concerned about at the moment is that the upcoming so-called National Dialogue, which is what the ANC has proposed as a way of moving forward with the country, changing the policy direction, that kind of thing, and creating a sort of legitimacy for what the Government of National Unity's policy program is going to be. The DA is afraid that it's going to be hijacked by forces aligned basically to certain factions of the ANC. Ziller says that the DA feels anything but included in the process of organizing the National Dialogue. According to her, the National Dialogue is being organized from Deputy President Paul Mashatile's office in cooperation with the National Economic Development and Labor Council, NEDLAC. She says that the process is wholly inadequate. Ziller said, "We're in a power-sharing agreement with the ANC, sorry, a power-sharing government with the ANC, and we have to be central to planning the National Dialogue, determining participation, and framing a proposed outcome. NEDLAC does not adequately represents civil society. I have scores of names of organizations that must be included to make this dialogue meaningful." And apparently, she and the Secretary General of the ANC, Fikile Mbalula, are meeting in Johannesburg about this week on Thursday. Also, being asked about the dynamics of the Government of National Unity, Zilla was very candid, I think, about the DA's approach to this whole thing. She said, "The GNU is very stable at this point. The reason is that people realize what the alternative is. It's very seldom that you can say there's no alternative. We know that if we want to save South Africa at the moment, there is no alternative." When asked about the importance of Ramaphosa to the survival of the GNU, Ziller said, "That's a very big question, even more of a challenge for us to make it work. If President Ramaphosa goes, it obviously depends on who succeeds him. If Paul Mashatile succeeds him, from everything I know and have read about Paul Mashatile, the going won't be smooth for us, and that it would be very unfortunate if the GNU collapsed." If the GNU collapses, she said, either Cyril Ramaphosa will have to run a minority government or do a coalition with someone else. The only parties essential to the GNU are the DA and the ANC. The other parties can't bring the government down. They are there by the grace and favor of Cyril Ramaphosa. She then went on to talk about what she called the realignment of South African politics. She said that this was now inevitable, as due to our proportional representation system, no party would ever get above 50% of the vote again. She said the realignment has to happen down the middle of the ANC, which has to go apart because there's such an ideological divergence between its various key players that they can't really form a coherent party anymore. She also said that her and Fikile Mbalula had a good professional relationship and that they WhatsApp each other regularly. Now, sort of the unspoken thing to me here, Terence, seems to be this idea that the DA, I think, wants to split the ANC off, perhaps from some of its more radical left elements. Thinking here particularly of certain unions within the COSATU Federation, certain ANC politicians, and of course the South African Communist Party, which I think actually played into this when the South African Communist Party Secretary General attacked the GNU at over the weekend, saying that the ANC was cozying up to white monopoly capital and had sold out to the Oppenheimers as well as international capital. The ANC, of course, pushed back on this, saying the GNU is not a sellout approach. We are not in alliance with the DA. So, Terence, what are your thoughts on all the things I've just laid out here? Do you think there's any chance that the ANC will actually split off from its more radical elements?
I think that this idea of the ANC splitting has been doing the rounds since before it was actually elected into government in 1994. And occasionally there were leadership figures who would voice that. Thabo Mbeki did at one point. I suspect, though, that you're not going to see a dramatic split. I think this is maybe where history has shown reality to be different, but I do think ongoing decline. My sense is that the ANC will probably stabilize, you know, with its current brand at maybe around 30% or so, perhaps a bit lower, perhaps a bit more, representing a sort of mixture of a traditional constituency, rural people, and that sort of aspirant periphery. People in townships and informal settlements, trying to get into the economy. I think she's quite correct in the days of its colossus-like hegemony being well and truly over. And I think this poses some interesting questions for the SACP, which at one stage had something like a third of, not quite a third, but I think something like 20% of seats in parliament, despite having never put its name on a ballot paper. So you know that they're going to have to decide what to do. They've been a passenger for 3 decades, and I think for various reasons, I think that the ANC can't bring itself to call this a coalition. I don't think it's an alliance. Maybe coalition is even too strong a word, but it is definitely a cooperative relationship fundamentally with the DA. I think that they hold their nose and they hold their lungs when they look at that. But as Franz Grenier was saying the other day, if you take their core constituency and the DA's core constituency, there is actually a fair amount of congruence in terms of what they want, and they are not direct competitors with each other. They represent fundamentally different groups. That's not the case with the EFF or MK, where there is a very strong element of competition and where they would, I think, want to cannibalize each other. So I think yes, you sort of stuck with this frigid cohabitation that where there was never love in the first place. It's kind of like when the one-night stand just, trapped you for the rest of your life.
So it's, Chris, I mean, it's kind of very interesting that, and I wrote a piece on the dailyfriend.co.za where it came out on, I think, Thursday, where I sort of described I've also said it on the show, that the DA and ANC are sort of tied together in a way that they couldn't, you know, that you wouldn't expect necessarily even a year ago. Their fates are very closely tied together. And even though their success in politics now very much depends on each other, each is kind of trying to destroy the other. I think the ANC probably wants to absorb the sort of more left-leaning parts of the DA and regain its majority of 50%, although I don't know if that's actually possible. And the DA wants to slice off the left-leaning parts of the ANC and kind of maybe make a deal with the remaining parts so you can have a sort of center-left, center-right coalition rather than the sort of bizarre ANC big tent coalition plus the DA plus all these other little parties. What do you make of Terence's thoughts and mine?
No, I agree with that analysis along the lines of a strong contestation. Like, given the drop in vote share for the ANC, I mean, in 2004, they were almost at 70% on their own. Now in 2024, dropped to just 40%. I mean, what that does to you in terms of a member, a card-carrying member, but also maybe a minister, someone in the leadership in the NEC, what that does to your view of your party, its history, its ideology, its current place in South Africa. I mean, serious questions are asked. So that opens up opportunities for minds and ideas to be changed. I'm not saying it's easy and it's guaranteed to manifest in positive ways, but there's an opportunity, for example, for a party like the DA and the IFP in working with the ANC in government, trying to influence people within the organization. And I think you're seeing that vying the whole time. So you try and retain access to set resources, you try and implement your ideas, but at the same time, you're trying to now deal with this big drop in your vote share, not just from 2004 till now, but of course from 2019 when the party had 57% and now 40%. So that's one part of it for the ANC. On the DA side, I mean, here you see trying to really strike and maintain not a balance, but I guess the longer term vision. So yes, you've got the short term opportunities and you could impact things in a positive sense in terms of narrative and perception around the government and getting growth going, et cetera, et cetera. But longer term, where do you set out your stall in South African politics for the next local elections, for the next general elections, should the trajectory of decline for the ANC continue as it is? I don't know if, I don't think by the next elections, the ANC will be at 10%, for example, but I don't really see it getting back to about 50%, for example, given the changing demographics of the country in terms of urban, rural, economic growth prospects, how the party has performed. So what then fills that void? Is it a party like the DA, parties adjacent to it, similar ideas around maybe centrism, pragmatic reforms, pushing for economic growth, labor market reforms, or is it more radical and populist elements who play into concerns around things like immigration, the constitution is a Western import, that's why all of our problems are what they are, wanting to overthrow institutions and subvert them, et cetera, et cetera. So all of this, I think, is part of that long-term calculus for the DA and, again, trying to maintain keeping that your eye on that particular ball versus using the opportunities that you have now. Just the last point, I think the highlighting the opportunities around a national dialogue, but also to make it, you know, very clear, if you don't get that buy-in, especially from civil society groups, what then ultimately weight does it carry? What if you're really sidelining those entities, as the ANC is alleged to be doing? Yeah, it doesn't carry that sort of buy-in that you want as a government, I think, over the longer term. But it does. It fits into the model of things like maybe BUSA and some others, where it's big labor, big government, big business together. They can all acknowledge the problems, but the ideas and proposals that they present, those solutions, if truly implemented, things like more economic freedom, labor market reforms, they would lead to more competition for those vested interests. So if those are the only people in the room, there's no incentive really to get those things going. So if you don't get really other players involved, other stakeholders, it becomes more of a talk shop, I think, than anything else.
I just like to say that I can't help thinking that this national dialogue looks remarkably like Social Compact 2.0.
Yeah.
Like maybe we'll, you know, throw in a NGO coalition on top of it or something like that. But I think fundamentally this is about, you know, that compact where, you know, business will agree to invest X, Y, Z, and labor will, you know, accept, you know, 1 hour less, you know, work, or 1 hour more working time a week or something like that. And the government will promise not to steal everything.
And that's a panacea for the real problems, right? So yes, you put some bandage over the short-term problems. You privatize this particular pier at Durban Port or Richards
Bay. You're not going to get privatization.
You don't solve the long-term.
I don't think we'll go that far.
Yeah.
But you know, look, I think fundamentally this is it. But it also plays into the idea that South Africa has this wonderful, you know, like dialogue is always our go-to solution. It's a bit like Harry Potter's wand. You know, if you wave it, you'll get all sorts of weird things happening. And you know, look, South Africa does not have a wonderful record of dialogue and problem solving.
Mm.
You know, that was a one-off thing back in the 1990s when one government wanted to give up and a competitor wanted to take over. But, you know, that's dialogue is a skill that's got to be relearned now.
Yeah.
I think a big part of the national dialogue is really that I think the ANC wants to build some sort of legitimacy for its policy platform. And, you know, it wants to be able to go to its coalition partners in the GNU and say, no, what we have to do this because the nation, as represented by the National Dialogue, has told us to. And that'll probably be, you know, a lot of more of the same. And I think the DA is very right to worry about exactly what that National Dialogue will contain. It needs to be a genuinely, you know, if it's going to have any value whatsoever, other than being just another rubbish social compact thing where everyone just promises to be on their best behavior, you actually need to have a big diversity of views and generally come out with something that is, you know, different from what we've done up till now. Otherwise, you know, it's just a huge waste of time.
Can I push back a little bit on that? I'm not sure. I think this idea that we need diversity of views and we need to discuss and exchange, I think that very, very easily becomes cover for not doing anything at all. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, saying, well, you know, I can't do this and I can't do that. You know, maybe you actually need somebody to say, look, you know, I'm the president of this country and I'm going to do X, Y, Z. And, you know, if you want to hang me on the courthouse lawn, fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm actually going to take a risk.
No, I do actually agree with you there. Yeah. The reason I say there should be a diversity of views is because I fear that if the president just says, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, we're just going to get a lot more of the same. If the president says, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and it's something different, then, you know, I'm kind of on board with that. Okay, let us move on to our next story. And this is one that's actually been bubbling around in a big way in the public consciousness for the last couple of weeks, and that is the alleged racism row around Pretoria Girls High School. Now, there are a number of weird things about this story. Firstly, it consists of talking about a WhatsApp group with a bunch of high school girls on it. These high school girls were talking amongst themselves about things they didn't like about. They were white girls in this WhatsApp group, and they were complaining about various things about the school, in particular, some of the things their black colleagues, or I don't know what's the name for pupils, anyway, other pupils, had said or done or were complaining about at the school. These conversations took place in 2023. For some reason, they only sort of seem to have come into the public consciousness now. And there was the usual sort of racial uproar kind of stuff. We had, you know, Panyaza Lesufi getting very excited about this. We had the EFF talking about systemic racism at the school and that the suffering the indignity 30 years after apartheid, bringing up issues around some of the black students at that school in 2016 had protested because they said the hair policy was discriminatory against black students. There was a lot of fire and fury about the whole thing. The school governing board held a disciplinary hearing for the 12 girls implicated in this thing and has just found them all not guilty of racism, among various things, citing weak evidence. So I think all or most of them were prefects, and they've actually been reinstated since. However, the Gauteng Department of Education says that while it accepts the school governing board's inquiry, and it's not going to reopen anything into the 12 students who are accused of racism, the department is now going to investigate if there is a, quote, culture of racism at the school. And the department's decision is motivated by the fact that the report of the SGB's ruling made no mention of racism or discrimination against pupils, whereas there's been a strong presumption of the existence of such at the school, said a spokesperson for the education department in Gauteng. The SGB's ruling further stated that inconsistencies in the testimonies and lack of solid evidence from the WhatsApp group contributed to the SGB's decision to find the pupils not guilty. Therefore, the department cannot interfere with the outcome of the SGB's as they are empowered by law to initiate and facilitate disciplinary hearings against pupils. As such, any transgression of a school's code of conduct is a responsibility of the school governing board, which enforces appropriate action. So, Terence, you wrote a piece in the Daily Friend today, or that was published today on this. What are your thoughts on this incident?
I think it's sad. I think it's sad that in a country where millions and millions of kids receive a substandard education that does not prepare them for a modern economy, you know, we're going after a WhatsApp conversation. A WhatsApp conversation, incidentally, whose full contents are not known, but extracts of which have appeared in publications not famously sympathetic to white racism. And the best we can get is, you know, stuff that I think you could maybe describe as insensitive. But then again, we're a diverse society. That doesn't just mean that we have different DNA. It also means that people see things differently. I also find it chilling when I see a department statement saying there's a widespread presumption. This, remember, is a society where we had a hugely compromised president about which there were many suspicions, including charges having been laid, but he was always to be considered innocent until proven guilty. Apparently, that doesn't stop when you've got a presumption in the air about a girls' school in Pretoria. I think it's dreadful, and I think that the conduct of the Gauteng Education Department has been abominable. But more than that, you know, I think that this has shown huge deficiencies in the capacity of the media and the commentariat, the constant restating as fact things that are currently in the realm of allegation. I've checked the story very closely, and there's lots of reliance on people are speaking on conditions of anonymity, making vague generic statements, and virtually no pushback. Well, can you be more specific? Who is the person you're talking about? We've seen this again and again and again, and unfortunately, this is the stuff of race warriors, not a few of whom seem to be headquartered in the Gauteng education department. Remember the things like the cupcake scandal, where the then MEC and current premier could drop everything to rush to Pretoria and post pictures of Django Unchained whipping people. You know how he's dealing with the racists, even though he knew nothing more about them than the rest of us. And I've said this before. In situations like this, for those who want to, who want to throw up their hands in mock anguish about the children, remember that those children function as nothing more than little props in your obscene morality play.
Well said. This stuff really kind of irritates me, because it's so, it has such an air of manufacture to it. High school girls were saying nasty things about, or unkind things about their peers in a WhatsApp group. I mean, if we're going to start investigating that, then every single girls' school in the country is going to have some serious problems. it's so clear that, you know, there are people trying to make political hay out of this. Terrence?
I don't think every girls' school in the country would, because this is something that is focused on, let's say, more upmarket schools, because there is money there, and that is where certain parasitic pecuniary interests can insert themselves to get contracts to do diversity training. You are not going to see this in Pimville or in the Cape Flats or anything. It's also why, you know, why, and I come back to this, why is a WhatsApp conversation in a Model C school front page news, whereas the failure to teach basic maths and literacy to generations of kids in townships who desperately need that, you know, is just sort of a background hum in our national conversation.
No, exactly. Chris, any thoughts on this issue?
I think number one, the constant shifting of goalposts. So if you're now going to investigate and try and establish whether there's a quote-unquote culture of racism, how is that defined? How do you prove that? Is the point, maybe the point isn't to prove it. It's just that you can continue to grind this particular axe. It's useful in some narrative opportunities. You can look like you're concerned about the children and about society in general. So it's useful in that regard. And secondly, yeah, if just how interesting it is when these things crop up every now and then, and how they are dealt with by the authorities. So not in a way, for example, so when the report came out, not expressions of relief and happiness on the part of the department that, you know, these very serious concerns actually turned out not to be true, according to the investigation that was conducted, but actually just expressing disappointment. What does that say about your attitude towards this kind of thing and towards issues like racism?
Of course, one of the very irritating things about this is every now and again, something genuinely racist does happen somewhere in a school to someone. And when you have kind of such politicization of these things, it means that when you do genuinely have things, there are going to be reasonable people who immediately cast doubt on someone claiming racism, even if it turns out to be true, because they're so used to these manufactured nonsense stories which come out of things. This hurts everyone except some of the politicians who are trying to ride on the wave here. Anyway, we don't have that long left, but for our last story, let's just talk a little bit more about the training camp which was uncovered in Mpumalanga. So we did talk about this a little bit last week, but it appears that there's been more information that's now come out about the group of 95 Libyans who were arrested at this kind of private security / military style training camp in Mpumalanga. It's a group called Militaes Day Security Services in White River. That's the company that was hosting this thing. And, seems like they kind of should have checked more on exactly who they were accepting a contract for security training from. Security sources say that, the camp says that they accepted a contract from a company called Alwala. Sorry, my Arabic's not very good. To train these 95 guys. Turns out, however, that group is a front for another group called the Tariq Ben Zayed Brigade, which is affiliated with the Libyan warlord who controls the eastern half of the country, Khalifa Haftar, who apparently has sent these 95 guys here. They are sort of delinquents from one of the units, his special units, and they were sent here to be sort of retrained and to shape up and to stop behaving badly. Apparently, though, their handler, who was supposed to give them essentially some pocket money to when they left the camp to buy things, departed with all of the cash, at which point they sold their belongings to the local community for alcohol and drug money, and apparently caused lots of issues in the local community, starting fights with people being accused of all sorts of crimes, and till the police raided the place and have, I think, sent them all home for not fulfilling their visas. For lying about what they did on their visa applications. But Chris, this is a bizarre story. What do you make of this?
kind of bizarre, but also maybe not. When you've got less capable state security, less capable army, less capable police, it's easier to establish this kind of operation. And it becomes easier then to change it in ways if you need to adjust your strategy, etc., etc. This is, you know, partly why it's easier for groups, entities like the Wagner Group, now they're renamed to the Africa Corps, prefer to operate in jurisdictions, countries where there is less, the government isn't as well managed, I think, in many respects, as in some others. So, yeah, it highlights a trend that has been increasingly highlighted over the last year or so. The country's issues with our border security, but also our state security agency in general. And then, not that I have particular hard evidence in this regard, but given rife factionalism, competing interests, especially within the formerly biggest party in the country, when entities like the state security agency are used as proxies to wage some of these battles, I wouldn't put it past that some people within the state security agency, maybe in the army, in the police as well, would have known about this kind of thing and decided for whatever reason, whether pure corruption or otherwise, to turn sort of the other way. So I don't think this is the end of it. And it might likely manifest in different ways going forward.
Terence, what do you make of this story?
You know, from everything we can see, these guys were sort of here for some sort of semi-legitimate training. They don't appear to have been terrorists, and they made a nuisance of themselves, quite a violent one, but more because of indiscipline. However, I do think that sending close to 100 100 members of a militia to a place where they're probably going to get access to weapons
A militia has been accused of human rights abuses and war crimes.
Point is, these are not nice people. To a place where they get military training and have access to weapons. Yeah, for a long time it's been the prospect has been flagged. What if a group like, you know, Al-Shabaab or Al-Qaeda or whatever wanted to set up shop in South Africa? This is an intelligence failure.
No, that's exactly right. And I mean, they were all issued visas, so they were actually here legally. It wasn't even illegally.
McKenzie can't just like shout about the foreigners this time, eh? They came in with a proper documentation. That's what he always says. Documentation. You've got the documentation.
They were, but perhaps the visa
system didn't have money for the to support themselves
for their partying. So maybe the Department of Home Affairs and the State Intelligence Agency should take a better look at this one, because clearly they are not doing their job in properly vetting visa applicants. If you know, you can literally have a group of militiamen doing military training in Mpumalanga. Anyway. That's all the time we have for today. I hope you found the show interesting. We'll be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.